Thank you for the introduction. So, as you just said, I'm Jacob Suracha, I'm a postdoc at ICFO. And today I will present this talk that is called, you can read the title, it's called Stateless Trivia Beyond Bias Retrodiction and Reverse Processes. It is a work that I finished some time ago with a colleague of mine, also a friend of mine, Matteo Scandi, that started from a really, really super naive question that was, sorry that I have a menu. How to reverse a not reversible channel. So just one question before starting. Can you see the cursor of the mouse?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So as I was saying, this is a really naive question because as you say, there is a clear contradiction inside of the questions. There are these two reverse, the first and the second, and we ask how to reverse a not reversible channel. So the fact is that you should intend the first reverse as an intuitive, the intuition behind the reversion, and the second one as a mathematical definition. So we take a not reversible channel, and we have sort of an intuition what does it mean to reverse a channel. Just think about time evolution. You can evolve something in time. You cannot invert this evolution, but you have an idea of inversion of time. So actually, the real question is, how to formalize the intuitive idea of the reverse of a not reversible channel. Well, okay. So in order to do that, what we started is just starting from really the basics, that is clarify in our mind what is a channel and where this not reversibility comes from. So we start from really simple examples, understanding what is a channel. So you imagine to have a set of states. Here I draw a set of states like this. You have each of these green boxes a state. And the channel is something that connects a set of states to another set of states. In this case, and in the following, we will always consider these two set of states that are equal, the same set of states. And channel, they can be expressed generally like this, but in this simple case can be interpreted in this way. So it's just a mapping of the first state to the second state with these arrows. Okay, so each state connects to a new state afterwards. Of course, channel can be composed. So the composition of channel is again another channel, and so on and so on and so on. You get as many channels as you want just by the composition of channel. Now, let's try to ask you, we take this channel that we just decided to consider, and we ask, what is the reverse of this channel? How to inverse the channel? Our intuition say that, okay, we just invert the direction of the arrow connecting the two sets, and we have the inverse of this channel. So apparently there are no problems. There are no problems because this is actually a reversible channel. So now that we understood what is a channel, we have a vague idea what is a channel, we want to understand what is the problem with not reversibility. And to do that, we make this channel not reversible. And we take this channel here. This is a bit different from the previous channel. And when you try to reverse it, you can find some problem. So the first problem that one can see is that if you ask what happens when you want to go back from this state here, you don't know where to go because this state is not connected to any state in the domain. So you don't really know how to go, where to go. And this is just the problem that this mapping is not surjective. But well, interpreting again this as a time evolution, you can say this is actually not a real problem, to be honest, because you will never reach this state. So why you should have the question of where to go back from this state? But looking a bit more, you have also a second problem, that this the missing of injectivity. So this channel is not injected. And this means that two states in the image maps to the same state in the codomain. And so when you ask how to go back from the state sigma 2, you don't know if you should go with this state or this state. So actually, you have a first intuition that reversing is not possible because you may forget where you came from. So when you're in the state sigma 2, you forget where you came from, from state rho or state rho second. So the first thing that we notice is that reversing a channel is an ambiguous task. You don't know how to go back. This is because you can choose many possible reverse channels. So there is not one single reverse channel, but you can imagine that there is a whole set of possible reverse channels. For this sort of mapping, there are just two. So you can go, you can choose the reverse vertical direction or this direction, but you can imagine channel where you have a big set of channels, okay? And even when you have this set, how would you choose one single reverse channel? What makes it special? Why there should be one channel that is the real reverse and all the others are like sort of reverse? We try to address this channel, these problems, but in order to start addressing these kind of questions, the best way to do it is maybe look at the literature before and see if anyone is talking about reverse channels already, if reverse channel exists or not, and so on. So we look for a canonical reverse channel of if anyone ever talked about reverse channels. And as soon as you do it, you find out that reverse channels are everywhere. People are using reverse channel for many different things, in many different topics, in many different, for many different things. So here I just bring you one example that, for example, in thermodynamics, where you study the direction of time, so why times flow in one direction and not in the others, there are many possible ways for justifying this sort of behavior of time, or better say, this sort of feeling of time. And one of these arguments works and is based on these fluctuation relations that are, I don't know, Crookes inequality or fluctuation relation in general. And these fluctuation relations are based on the definition of a particular reverse channel. So here, the justification for the direction of time is actually based on the construction of a reverse channel. You can look more around, you can look in other topics, you can look in other fields, and you find that all these possible reverse channels that people use and justify in many different ways, in a sense, they converge all to one that is the most commonly used reverse channel, that is, in the quantum case, the Petz recovery map. I'm not saying that it's just the Petz recovery map, but it's one of the most commonly used. Okay, so for some reason, there is a channel in the literature that is more special than the others. There is one preferred channel. Out of the set of all the possible reverse channels, you can choose one, and people choose one. Why? Well, Petz give his justification in these first papers, but we would like to have a common framework explaining why this is the unique or the reverse channel. And okay, so to do that, we look even more in the literature, and we find that actually this unique framework telling you what does it mean to invert the channel actually exists. Was introduced by this guy that is called Satoshi Watanabe, was a scientist that also is the one that is introduced in a way weak values in physics. And this guy, the scientist, say that the idea of reversing a channel coincides exactly with the idea of retrodiction. And the idea of retrodiction is this. So imagine you're at time t1, okay? And you want to guess what was the state that you had at time t0, that is earlier in time, knowing that at this time you have the state sigma. This kind of questions is actually, the answer to this question is what is retrodiction about? And we can like formulate more precisely in this way. So you have like three main ingredients, a channel, that is the channel that we want to find the reverse. You have an evolved state, that is the state that you have at this point in time, and you have a prior guess. So it is any possible other information you have, you encode in this prior guess, and you say, okay, I want to use all this information to understand what was my state at time t0. To do that, you use some inference techniques, you work out something, you do your calculations, and you obtain a new guess for the state at time t0. And you can say that this process here of inference was actually the reverse channel applied to the state sigma. So we say, okay, you have inference technique. These are canonical statistical inference methods. So you just take statistics, you take the statistical method for inference, you apply to a specific case of quantum channel or stochastic maps, and you obtain exactly the Petz recovery map, or the bias is phi reverse channel, that is actually the classical analog of the Petz recovery map. Okay, so this was first introduced by Watanabe, but the most recent and general result are from this work of Francesco Buscemi, Scarani, Evario Scarani, that, and then they developed further and further. So it seems that this kind of framework, this kind of idea, this kind of methodology tells you what is actually a reverse channel and also gives you the tool to derive one single reverse channel. But the problem is, I mean, if you look deeper in these kind of questions, you find that there is again an ambiguity. Because one apply, okay, the classical, the canonical statistical inference methods, but there are many possible inference methods in statistics. So why should we use Bayesian inference? Why exactly that one? And if you look inside of this topic, that is actually a really beautiful topic, there are many, many possible ways to justify Bayesian inference. And for example, here, the first doubt one can have is, okay, instead of using Bayesian inference, I use maximum likelihood. Well, you can see that in many cases, maximum likelihood is actually a dual with Bayesian inference. So you are sort of doing the same thing. You can even say, okay, instead of using Bayesian inference, I use the principle of maximum entropy. And you see that is sort of connected to Bayesian inference. So you can justify Bayesian inference in many different ways, depending on what kind of justification you prefer. Here I just show you a few, but there are so many justifications of bias inference. But still, as in the case of reverse maps, the same happens in the case of statistical inference. We miss a common framework explaining what does it mean to infer and so to justify one single method. So it seems that we cannot solve these questions in this way. So we try to be a bit more humble. And what we do is try to actually, we discover that it's actually a good question to answer if we can actually characterize the set of all the possible reverse channels. So we have an intuition of what the reverse channel should be. And we would like to tame this ambiguity. We would like to say, okay, these are all the possible states, the possible reverse channel. There's not one special, but our intuition or reverse channel can be formalized in this way. So this became our new aim for this work. Okay. And then if we are lucky and we can do that, we would like to understand these other questions. So why Bayesian inference? Maybe we can find out of this set a method to find the best map, the best reverse map. And maybe this method will find out that the best is actually biased, so we have a justification. Or maybe this method will find another reverse map. And so we'll say that bias is not actually so important or so fundamental. And we can start this study. And to start this study, we have to go a bit more in the formal setting. And to do that, I chose to represent everything in the classical scenario. So yes, a question, let's see.
Oh, I just wanted to ask, when you say better retrodiction map, do you have some operational task in mind for?
We don't know yet. Now we're just ideas. We don't know what does it mean, but we will expect first, we represent what our intuition or reverse channel is mathematically. And then slowly, maybe we develop the taste and we will find a reason why one map should be better than the other. But for now, we have no idea. We just have to explore a bit.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Okay, so as I was saying, I will explain this using classical stochastic maps, and because they are nicely, you can make nice drawings, it's easier to understand, you can picture them easily, but you can also see every time you will see a phi or a phi or a rho, you can think about a quantum soundness or a CPTP map and a quantum state. This is why I use also this notation for probability vector. So just a quick recap of stochastic maps. You can have probability vector that are just vector with positive entries that sums to one. So each entry is actually a probability. And stochastic maps are matrix where each element inside the matrix is a positive between 0 and 1, and each column sum to 1. So in this way, we have that if we apply a stochastic map to a probability vector, we obtain another probability vector. And this representation, this graphical representation, mathematically just expressed in this way as a matrix multiplication. Good. Okay, so now that we have our basic tool for exploration, we start exploring. And we take a really simple example of two-dimensional stochastic maps so we can picture it. So we take this stochastic map. I chose it randomly, but it's nice to see the picture of this one. And the probability vector is this one, and is parameterized by a single parameter, this p, that is a number between 0 and 1, because we're the constraint that these two numbers must sum to 1. So analogously to the case that I showed you before, where we had the domain that was the set of these green boxes, here the domain is this line where the parameter p go from 0 to 1. This is the domain, and each point of this domain is actually a state. The action of the map is represented by these arrows. So the point t equal 1 is mapped to this point 0.75, for example. And you can imagine that all these arrows are dense here. So this is actually the graphic representation of the effect of the map. And here you can see I plotted just an animation for different kind of stochastic maps in two dimension. The point is that you can see, you can even flip things. There is already enough freedom to play around with this simple example. Okay. But there are also differences from the simple example that I showed you before with a discrete number of states, with finite number of states. For example, we have that in the case of quantum channel and in classical stochastic maps, there is the loss of information comes mainly from the property of contractivity of map. So while I showed the finite case of before, the contractivity, in a sense, you can really vaguely connect it to the missing of surjectivity. Here you see that you will never reach the state, but if you apply the channel more and more, you don't lose more information, you are there. Why the contractivity for this kind of channels? You will see that at each step, you lose more and more information until you reach one single point eventually. But okay, so this is the idea of contractivity. It can be formalized better with distances or divergences between points, but by now, let's stay in this really just picture framework where you see the contractivity, you can just connect it with the idea that, okay, you have this domain, it's mapped to a smaller set, smaller in the sense of picture. Okay, so we have to remember that channels, quantum, and the classical never expand. This is a property of channels. Good. So finally, we can start thinking about what is a reverse channel. And to do that, the first thing we notice, now I'm really making super easy observation, but this is what we actually want to do. We want to just write it down, this kind of observation. We discover that the central object of study for finding a reverse channel is the composition of the forward and reverse channel. So we want to focus in this picture where we consider this, where we have one the map that we choose and one possible reverse channel. And the idea is that the ideal reverse channel should recover everything perfectly. So the composition should be as close as possible to the identity channel. In this case, for example, if you start from the point equal 1, you go to 0.75, and you would like to recover again the point p equal 1. Okay, so just to keep in mind, the central object must be this one, the composition of the forward and backward channel. So from this, it seems that the easy answer to what is a reverse channel is just taking this one. But as I said before, channel cannot expand. So this is actually forbidden. This cannot be a channel. So we have to think a bit more. So this is actually something that we have to remember. It's forbidden. What is a channel? Well, so again, we ask what is a reverse channel. We can think about possibilities. For example, in this case, maybe this one is a good reverse channel. You see, it is recovering as much as possible. But we can have like specific cases where, for example, in the original map, it's flipping in a way. And if you do the same strategy of before, here you are committing this error in the recovery. So the state p equal 1 goes here, and then it's mapped here, and you have all this error in the recovery. So it will be a much better recovery map or retrieval map, this one, where you have another flip. And this gives you already another intuition about what a reverse channel should be, a good reverse channel should be. So you would like to have, for this composite map of the forward and backward channel, to be without flips together. So this plus this makes this kind of map is completely just contractive. And now we try to formalize these ideas. And we have the first really simple principles to say what is a reverse channel, what does it mean to reverse a channel. So the first principle is just that if we can reverse the channel, so if the inverse exists, we should just take the inverse. It's, of course, we do that. The second principle is that we want for the reverse to be physical. So we want it to be a channel. In the case of stochastic map, we want a stochastic map. In the case of quantum channel, we want a quantum channel. This can be justified because we are talking about quantum channels and we're talking about reverse channels in classical and quantum case, but also can be justified in different ways, maybe more like, for example, if you think about one-shot measurement or stuff like that, but this can be explained later. Just now, we just want a state, a physical channel. And then the idea that we want for the forward and backward channel composed to not have flips inside can be formalized in the fact that we want for the back and forth map to have all the eigenvalues positive. In the case of 2D, we just have flips. But if you go to higher dimension, already in the classical case, you can have even rotations. And you would like to avoid this kind of stuff. So you would like to have just purely contractive. In the case of quantum channel, you will have even unitary evolution. So phases and stuff. And you want to avoid this in the retrieval channel because it will just commit a mistake or insert an error in your retrieval that is not what you want. Good. Then what else we can do? Well, from what we have seen by now, to understand what is a good reverse channel, we just look at property of channels, general property, and we try to exploit them. So what is another property of channels? The fact that, I mean, there is a theory, it's known that every channel, both for stochastic maps and quantum channels, have a fixed point, at least one fixed point. And this is a property of channels. This fixed point exists. And we don't want to waste a property of channel not taking into consideration. So we want to put in this property all the knowledge, the additional knowledge we have. And so the fixed point will take sort of will work as the prior in the inference settings. And we will ask for all the additional information that we have to be encoded in the fixed point of the back and forth channel. So if we have any guess about the original state or the state that we would like to retrieve, we put this guess as the prior as the fixed point of the back and forth map. So in the case our guess was correct, the formalism will actually confirm this fact. Good. So we can formalize this idea with just this request. So the fixed point of the back and forth channel must be the prior. And then we want for this prior to be the equilibrium state for this back and forth channel because we want the evolution to be as symmetric as possible around this state. Okay. For now, I just talked. This principle seems really easy and I just talked and we want to formalize them in a mathematical sense nicely. So in order to do that, we remember what are our basic ingredients. That is, we have a stochastic channel, that is this channel phi, and we have a prior where we encode all the possible information, additional information we have on this retrieval, That means all the possible information we have about the original state where we were starting from. And we translate those requests in mathematical requests. So the first request for physicality was actually for this channel, for these maps, for the retrieval map that I show with the tilde, to be a left stochastic map. Okay, so it is a channel. Then we want that the back and forth channel has positive eigenvalue, with this idea that they cannot rotate or flip or stuff like that. Then we have this principle where we ask for the retrieval map to have a fixed transition. Having a fixed transition because we want for the back and forth map to have a fixed point that corresponds to the prior. So if the original channel sends the prior to the state phi pi, then we want, of course, the retrieval map to send the state phi pi into pi again. So this map must have a fixed transition. And then we have the tail balance condition for having this state, the prior, as equilibrium state for the back and forth map. If we look at these principles, at this thing that we ask, we see that collecting the two purple ones together, we characterize a convex set that has a finite set of vertices. And these vertices can be computed actually with an algorithm invented by this Jurcut and Reiser, okay, in the literature. So these two conditions identify this set here. And these other two conditions, the one in green, identify this other set, that is the set of positive semi-definite matrices. So we have the space of the trigger channel is the intersection of these two. So it's a set, a convex set, with these vertices. And so we have also that each reverse channel, reverse channel in this set of possible reverse channels can be identified by just this vector of coefficients. But since it's a convex combination and just a probability vector, so we can characterize each possible convex, each possible reverse channel by a probability vector. Good. So it seems that we found a way to characterize this whole set of possible reverse channels that are compatible with our intuition. Okay, once we have this, we are happy, but we want also to study a bit more to see if there is a reason why one should choose an optimal reverse channel, an optimal retrieval channel. And we want to investigate this kind of question. To that, we take again our stochastic maps, our representation of stochastic maps. And we see that actually the idea was already there before. A reverse channel is better, it works better, it contracts the least. So each channel must always contract or at least not expand. We know that the composition of the forward and backward channels cannot have flips or introduced mistakes of that kind because of our principle. So the best retrieval channel should be the one that compressed the least in the composition. So these two composed should compress the least. In this case, it's really easy. You can just put identity because you cannot do better. But in this case, the principles connect these two channels together. So you have a request on this eigenvalue and also on the fact that this should compress the least. So you can see here, you just have a flip. This is a permutation because it's not contracting. So we take this idea seriously and we transform it in a request, in an optimization principle. And the idea is that the forward and backward channel should compress the least. How to formalize it? We ask for this optimization criterion, that is the optimal retrieval map is the one that maximizes the determinant of the fourth and back channel. So this is the optimal channel. Out of all the state retrieval channel defined in the space that we chose before, the optimal one is the one that maximizes the determinant. If you remember from the class of algebra in university, the determinant of Lyon transformation is actually the volume, is proportional to the volume of Lyon transformation. So this is actually a formalization of this idea that you want the minimal contraction. But okay, so I presented these talks a few times, but not these talks particularly, I presented the poster, and people were not convinced by this explanation why the determinant should be a really good quantity to maximize. But I have two other reasons to convince you that the determinant is good. So the first reason is, the second reason, sorry, is that if you want to compute the now this divergence between the back and forward map with the identity, so sort of a distance between the identity and the forth and back map, you would like to have this distance minimized, because it means that the backwards channel would recover completely the state. So you want to minimize this distance. If you compute it, you do the first expansion, you do this other expansion, then you see that using this famous property that the trace of the logarithm is equal to the log of the determinant, minimizing this distance, this divergence, actually corresponds to maximizing the determinant. So maximizing the determinant is connected to minimizing the contraction, and to minimizing also the distance between the retrieval channel with the identity. And then if you are not convinced and you are a bit of a more practical person, you can take the book of Van der Berge, the boss of semi-definite programming, and you see that there are actually two kinds of problems that are computable efficiently. One is the semi-definite programming, but also the terminal maximization is one of these. So it's really good. This was a surprise when I found it. Good. So we have also a criterion for deciding what is the optimal retrieval channel. And we analyze a bit this thing. So we take an example. So we take again our basic ingredients, a stochastic channel, our prior. We characterize this set of possible retrieval channels by this fixed transition and intersection with the semi-definite matrices. We run the optimization algorithm for finding the optimal retrieval map, and we find the optimal retrieval map. It's also unique for this property of this set. Really good. But once we have this, looking at this picture, one can think, okay,
is there any intuition as to why there should be sort of a unique channel which maximizes the determinant?
It's written in this paper of this problem that is maximizing the determinant, okay? Mm-hmm. Is called also centering something. I don't really remember, but it's proved here that is unique. Oh, sorry.
Like unique, or like unique up to rotation? I mean, like, that's unique is just surprising.
We removed already all the rotation from the principles. Because we want the eigenvalues to be positive and so on.
Okay, well.
Okay, sorry. Okay, so I start here. Let me just turn on the light. Good. Good. So look at this. Now you have this optimal retrieval map, but you see that this set is the set of all the possible retrieval of this channel. Of all of this channel here. But you can think now of taking the retrieval of the retrieval, and you should add a parametrization of the set of the forward maps. You can do that, and you just take this with the same principle and so on. You take, since these two are connected, so it's really easy. The only thing that actually changes is just this transition. And the space of the forward channels actually has the property that the vertices are the same on this set, but are just the self-adjoints. So you take the dagger of these vertices and you obtain this other set, that is the set of the forward channels. And so if the maps here are parameterized by a probability vector with dimension n, here is the same and the vertices are almost the same, just the dagger. But in this space, somewhere, there must be your stochastic map, your original channel. So you can find it, and you find the vertices, one set of coefficients that are characterized your original map. Nice. So what you can do, apart looking at it and being happy because it's nice, well, you can ask, now you have, maybe there is a linear transformation between these two spaces that connects this map to the optimal one. Well, not, because the optimization was non-linear. But what happens with linear transformation? I don't know. We studied a bit, and we started by taking the simplest linear transformation, that is the identity. So what happens with the linear transformation with its identity? You find that the reverse channel that you find here is actually the, in the quantum case, the PETS map, or in the classical case, and this bias, the classical PETS map, in a sense, or the bias-inspired reverse map. So it looks like the PETS map, or the bias inverse, can be justified by the simplicity of the transformation. So this parametrization is actually, in a sense, encoding already the idea of bias inference by this identity. So, okay, we have this. And as last thing, we say, okay, but now we have two maps, two reverse channels, the bias one, or the PETS map, and the optimal one. And they are not the same, they are different. Can we compare them? Can we see what is the difference between them? Is it actually really true that this optimal retrieval map is better than the PETS? And for which kind of criterion is better, apart that for this determinant? And here I show you some example of this, some comparison between these two maps. So here I compare this distance is the distance between the original distance, sorry, this divergence is the divergence between your initial state and your recover state. So you evolve it forward in time and you go back and you see how well you recover. So in a sense, this is these vertical lines, the vertical axis encodes the error, or the how bad it is the retrieval. And we compare in the classical case, in the quantum case. So in the classical case, we again take the case of two dimensions. So we had one single parameter. On this, there are all the possible states. And we compare the optimal map with the bias one. And you see that actually the optimal one always recovers better your state. In this case, and here we plotted with just another kind of prior. And here I did the same for the quantum case, where this is like in the qubit, you take just the maximum circle in the one maximum circle and you plot the distance. I plotted this quantity because proper distances, the drawing was not this nice, but the idea was the same. So the green one was always on top of the purple one, so the optimal recovers always better than the PETS map in these cases.
Can you just briefly explain the one dimensionality of the axis rows? Because like you're talking about the mixedness of the state in the blocks here. Like what's one this dimension, one parameter? In it? Yeah, you said like, so, because we're dealing with two dimensional states, it's one parameter.
Okay, this is one parameter because in just the stochastic, this is the classical case. So you have probability vector with two dimensions. Oh. So it's P minus rho minus one minus rho. This is classical. Okay. And this is quantum, where X and Y are just the coordinate in the block sphere on the maximum circle. Okay.
Thanks.
And okay, this is nice. I liked it, but we want to see an intuition behind this. And then I'll show you an intuition in the quantum case, where I plotted a channel. I take this channel and this prior, okay, it's always the same basic ingredient. And here in the first panel, I show you the action of the channel that I chose, this action phi, this channel phi, that maps the block sphere into this shape here. So this, the block sphere is contracted and a bit shifted and bit translated down. So that, for example, the prior is moved to the point phi pi. These are the two retrieval channels. The purple one is the optimal, and the green one is the PETS. And you can see that why the optimal, how all the criteria are encoded, because the optimal is just shifting the phi pi to pi, so it's preserving the prior that you wanted. contracting the least possible, because a bit less contracting will go out of the block sphere, not being a channel, but it's contracting the least possible. While the PETS map, in a sense, is shifting again, because this is what the PETS map does, but it's contracting more, like it's contraction, but it's not needed. And when you compose the two together, so you see that actually the back and the forth and back channel maps the prior in itself. And that with the PETS map, you have a huge contraction, while with the optimal one, you have a smaller contraction. So this is sort of a geometrical intuition of why this thing works. And okay, so out of these results, you can also find the general analytical results. So for some sort of maps, you have that the identity is always the best retrieval map, even though the PETS cannot be even though the PETS sometimes is not identity. And this is just for giving you a taste of these results. And well, okay. And as a last thing to close, and then if we have time, we can go more into detail. There are more technical slides. Is the questions, where does bias come from? So we managed to characterize a set of retrieval maps, of reverse maps. We managed to find the optimal one. We managed to find where bias come from. But maybe there is some principle that you can ask more, and you can shrink the space of all the possible retrieval maps to one single retrieval map that is the biased one. So in order to do that, we take again this example, this graph that we showed before, and we notice, okay, that simplicity can be a criterion. So bias is the simplest one. As soon as you have the parameterization, you can find the biased one. But well, it's not really. Doesn't make people happy, this kind of, not even me. No one is happy with that. But you notice something that now, if you take the retrieval of the retrieval with this kind of Lyon transformation, you obtain again the original map. While in the case of the optimal map, when you take the retrieval of the optimal, it's something else. You don't always recover the original map. So maybe, can we add the property to isolate the bias and the PETS map? Well, maybe, and we found that this property is asking for this involutivity. So this map to be the reverse of the reverse to be the initial channel. This problem is actually difficult. So we tested numerically, and it's not a numerical test in the sense that you run a lot and we take statistics and we check, but for fixed dimension, there are finite number of tests that you can run and know if actually this is true. And we check for some dimensions, we run all the tests, and the only map that was involutive, linear, and with all the other property was the PETS map. And okay, so the conclusions are this one. So we dealt with this ambiguity in defining a reverse channel by characterizing the set of admissible retrieval channels, these channels. We get a computable criterion for choosing the optimal retrieval channel. We found also this the bias in this space and the PETS map in this space. And we maybe found the reason found the criterion for isolate the bias map out of this space to a single map. And that's it. So now this is the presentation, just for giving an idea. Then I prepared other slides if you want to go more in the detail in the actual, like for example, how to write the coefficients, how to write the actually these spaces and so on and so on. Or to see the test is to see the bias and so on. Good.
Thank you so much. That was really interesting, well presented. Let's open up for questions, and if you have time or questions, lead us to the technical slides. So yeah, any questions?
Maybe I'll start. I didn't quite understand, if you go back to the slide where you introduced the second polytope, the one on the left, the pink.
I can go to this one, no?
Yeah, can you explain the space of forward channels again?
Okay, so let's go to this. No, I want to go to the slide where this one. Yes. So this is the space of reverse channels, no? And you have this property here. Now, if you want the space of forward channels.
Oh, sorry. Actually, let me ask a question about this. I just read the lambda vector. I mean, if your polytope is a simplex, then there's a unique way.
There's not a unique way.
There's lots of lambda vectors.
Yes.
At a given channel. Okay. Yes. Good. So go on.
Okay. In this case, you have, okay, your original map was already stochastic. So it's this one. This condition, the back and forth must have positive eigenvalues, is a condition that fixed both spaces in a sense, because this map is fixed at the beginning. Then you fix all the possible map here, the tilde, with that composed with your original as these positive eigenvalues. And you can, once you have found the optimal one, you can find all, you can, how do you say, variate this one to have all the possible map with positive eigenvalues.
So it's like all the forward, you know, the noise channels.
Yes.
For whom the optimal.
Yes. And of course, in that case, the original map is there for sure.
Right.
But you have many others.
Got it. Okay, so then if you go back to your pink set, the
go exactly here.
And so if phi is the original channel,
So now phi is in my original channel. And I don't know, in this case, for example, here we have a decomposition, and you can take the same vector coefficients in this space because there is this property of the vertices of these two sets and identify a new map that is the biased one.
Now that helps. So back years ago when we thought about this, we had imagined that you could sort of interpolate between, like, just in the classical case. In many circumstances, so correct me if I'm wrong, first of all, that the optimal retrieval map in the classical case will often correspond to a kind of maximum likelihood estimate. Is that correct or not?
It's coming from Bayesian inference. That is the dual of maximum likelihood. So in a sense, yes.
Okay. And so, you know, if I see the outcome of the channel and I have a posterior distribution over the inputs,
yes,
maximum likelihood, I should guess the input that gets the highest posterior.
Mm-hmm.
That's better than just sampling from that posterior and then reporting that. You know, that's what adds the noise. So then
I don't really understand completely what you ask, but there are two different things that you can do, no? Because if you have a posterior, you want to find the best prior, for example, you want to find the best one, then you are looking for a sort of what is called the reference prior, but is the prior that maximizes the information that you gain with a measurement. And this is another kind of questions. So if you have already a prior,
right?
Okay, and you want to update it, then you can update it with Bayesian inference, but in a sense can be mapped to maximum likelihood or to other principles. Yes. So your question was: I have a prior, that is my guess of what I have at the beginning. Yeah. I want to update it with any new information that I have.
Yeah.
Okay. I do it with Bayesian inference. What kind of maximization principle this Bayesian inference update corresponds?
Mm-hmm.
Was this your question?
I don't think so. But let me tell you how I was thinking of it, and maybe you can say how it's different from what you're doing. That so take the example where you just have a classical bit.
Yes.
And it goes through a noisy channel like the one you had.
Yes.
With 75% probability, it comes out.
Let me just find some slides that maybe can help.
And 75%, it's identity, 25%, it's flip. Like, suppose that's your noise channel.
Yes.
Noise channel. So now if you say, if the task were to say, I'm just trying to guess correctly what the actual input was, right? Mm-hmm. So I get the output from the noise channel and I want to make my best.
The actual input in this case was the weight of the flip.
No. I want the actual bit value. So maybe I'm playing a game where I get rewarded if I can guess correctly whether the bit input into the channel was zero or one.
Okay.
So one strategy in this game would be, I get the output from the channel.
Yes. And
because it's 75% likely to be identity and only 25% likely to be flip, I guess whatever bit comes out of the channel.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if it was a different channel that maybe reversed the two, I would guess the opposite. But what would certainly be worse is if I start and I say, well, what's the distribution over the output bit for a uniform prior? And then my strategy mm-hmm. will be to sample from my posterior. So I could imagine looking at the output of the channel. Let's say I get output zero.
Yes.
I say, well, what's my posterior about the input? Well, there's some probability that it was zero and some probability that it's one.
Mm-hmm.
Then I could just sample from that posterior and say, that's my guess as to what it was. That's obviously worse than reporting the maximum likelihood that my posterior dictates. So I think I'm playing a different game in a way, because I'm sort of, I have a figure of merit in mind where you're meant to try to get as close as possible to the actual physical state that was input, rather than the probability distribution.
Okay, I'm not really understanding clearly what you're asking, but in these cases, many times there is also this problem. Okay, the difference between sampling from what you get from the channel or just guessing or one or zero. So in your case, you're saying, okay, I can give a distributions between zero and one, something like that. This is the difference also between like one-shot measurements or not, because you can just saying or zero or one, you can go out of the domain. Of the codomain, no? So imagine you have a probability distribution of zero and one at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You make this distribution pass into the channel, you obtain another distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happens when you sample many, many times at the end. But if now you sample just once, you will not have a distribution. We will have or zero or one.
Yes.
And it is possible that all the possible distribution at the beginning are not mapped never to zero or one, are never mapped to zero or one. Also, or already in this example, this channel here, you see that nothing is mapped here.
Sure. I mean, so what I'm talking about is definitely a kind of a single shot task.
Yes.
Maybe it is different significantly from what you're doing, but I guess what I'm imagining is, suppose you know what the noisy channel is, so you have a characterization of what your noisy channel is.
Okay,
so it's this like bit flip error with 25% error. But your task is not your task is really going to be a single shot task, which is try to produce a bit value that's as likely as possible to be the bit that was input into the channel.
Okay.
And so as long as the, you're talking about the kind of channel we have on this slide, then you just want to take that output and make it your guess for the input. Because then you maximize mm-hmm. your
probability. Yes, exactly.
If you have the case where you're flipping.
You just flip again.
And you want to just do a permutation.
Yes.
And what I'm saying is that if I tried to use Bayes, like the kind of PETS recovery, it would suggest a different kind of strategy.
Yes.
And I think the right way of describing that strategy would be
to
first kind of do a Bayesian process where I say, given the output I actually observed, what's my posterior over the input bit?
Yes.
And then instead of taking the bit value that's most likely given that posterior, which is the strategy I described a moment ago. What you do is you just resample from that posterior.
Exactly. Yes. And in this case, we'll have a worse error. Using these values.
So anyways, sorry it took so long, but I guess what I was wondering was, at the time I was thinking about this, that it seemed natural to do something like the following. If you take the posterior and you exponentiate it, like you square it, you cube it, and so on, you'll get closer and closer to the sort of the maximum likelihood case, as long as there's no degeneracy. If they say the maximum likelihood point is unique, by taking products of that posterior, you're going to converge ultimately to the maximum likelihood, but you'll have this sort of nice interpolation between the kind of PETS recovery.
I mean what you're saying, but you're saying that this Bayesian inference will converge at the end to one single choice that is the one that is the best.
It's the pure state with the highest weight in decomposition.
I guess so. No, it's I'm not sure, but I sort of understand this convergence behavior, no, that you're talking about.
Okay, yeah. So I wonder if you could also talk about a kind of family of schemes that were between the Bayes point and the optimal recovery. But maybe the more interesting question is, what's mm-hmm. if you try to define a quantum version of the game I just described, where it's a sort of a one-shot game where my job is to try to recreate the initial state that was input into the channel, maximize the fidelity with that. Then I assume your optimal recovery in the quantum case does that. It gets
it should get us. I mean, in the quantum case, doing this, you can find some sort of inequality also for in the case of the relative entropy between the states and the recovered state. Okay, but this inequality I find on average, no? So you say, okay, on average, all the states, you have a better recovery in terms of relative entropy between the states. From this result, it looks even for each state, the relative entropy is better recovered.
So here's, if you go to the next slide, what I'm imagining is, so take the, I guess it's the green region on figure B.
Yes.
So I'm imagining something like this, that if I started out with some pure state on the surface of the block sphere.
Yes.
This recovery map gets me to some mixed state that's on that ellipsoid.
Yes.
The game I just defined would say, all right, once you've got that mixed state, what you really want to do is re-prepare the pure state that appears with the highest weight in that mixed state. So every one of those mixed states can be sort of thought of as the pure state on the block sphere mixed with the antimodal point. And so it's sort of like,
if you get this one, you will get the Z.
Right. And if you get something else, then you move out. Yes. That feels to me like the maximum likelihood procedure. So it's a bit what Ellie was saying, like these pure states are the ones that sort of have the maximal weight in the output of your recovery channel.
Okay, I understand what you mean, yes. And you say that doing this many times, what was that thing?
Well, I guess, forget the exponentiation thing. I guess we'd always tried to sort of sort out what the optimal quantum strategy was with this exponentiation idea, but you sort of have a different route. So I guess I'm wondering, is there a game I can define such that the optimal strategy really is to go and prepare this pure state, which is the one that appears with highest weight in the mixed state, which is the output of the channel?
Wait, because I remember that we thought about these things, but long time ago.
Okay.
I don't have any memory of this. I don't have any memories where we ended up with. But
It sounds to me like there's also something more qualitatively different in terms of what you're describing, Rob, and what I think Jacob was doing. Because like in the beginning of the talk, Jacob, you had these sort of like three ingredients which are sort of pertinent to the game, which
yes.
is prior knowledge,
yes.
like our prior belief about the state, our posterior knowledge, and what we know about the channel itself, which we're
yes.
trying to reverse. And it seems like when you set up this problem, you actually hold off on using your knowledge about the state that you see until like the very end of the problem. You just say like, here's the channel, here's my prior. And from
yes.
the channel and the prior, you do all of this work to define this
yes.
optimal recovery. And at that point, this optimal recovery thing doesn't depend at all on the state that you actually observe, right? It only depends
of course,
on the prior
because
and the...
Otherwise, right. I think otherwise you can always define the inverse, no? For a single state, you can find something that is not a channel, that maps your state to what you exactly had at the beginning, no?
Yeah, and I think Rob, like you, for you, like the it sort of plays in a different order. You're saying we know what we saw and we know the channel,
yes.
and so you're sort of incorporating that, and then the last thing that you do is incorporate your prior.
Yes, yes.
So it feels very different.
Yes, yes. On this, yes. But if you allow things to be constructed, just to recover something close to what you want to recover, then you can always find what you want, no? You can always inverse the channel but with something that is not a channel. Because you say, okay, for example, well, yes, what's the problem with not being a channel? Let's go to this drawing again. Here, that I say that this thing is forbidden. If you're saying, okay, I'm not allowed to put this state inside, I'm not even interested in what happens to this, I don't care. I mean, this is a good inversion. This is actually the best inversion. It recovers all these states, they recover perfectly. So if you know exactly what you want to recover, you can always sort of find something that is not a channel, but that recovers what you have. The idea is, though, that if in this case, imagine this is a coin, no? It can be or zero, it can be or this side or this side of the coin. If you measure it, then you will have or this posterior or this posterior, always. Probability one of having this or probability one of having this. So you want to have a channel if you want the single shot measurement in this scenario.
I guess I certainly am not proposing that one evaluates unphysical channels. I guess the problem I'm trying to articulate is that classically, if I know the noise, I know the stochastic map that characterizes the noise, and the challenge I'm trying to meet is, you know, I'm going to get the output of the noise channel and I get to process it and I'll be rewarded based on how frequently the output of my processing coincides with the actual input of the channel.
Okay.
My plan. And then it's sort of clear what one ought to do. And you know, one way to describe it is you go and you, as a good Bayesian, you compute your posterior about what the input was based on what you observed at the
mm-hmm.
output. You then calculate which of the inputs is most likely given that posterior.
Yes.
And you make that
yes.
your guess.
Yes.
It's always seemed to me that it should be possible to define an analogous quantum game and answer the question of what is the processing one ought to do given the output of the channel in the single shot case based on your knowledge of what the quantum channel implementing the noise is. And I guess
okay, now I understand
talk,
what you
I would,
say, yes.
I would have guessed that maybe your optimal recovery somehow is the kind of right sort of processing to do. But what I really would like to understand is, can I think of that as the absolute natural quantum analog of the classical scheme I just described, this maximum likelihood thing? Like there's
yes,
a sort of
yes,
weird
yes.
story about how the PETS recovery is the quantum analog of this unoptimal scheme where you just sample from your posterior and submit that.
The optimal recovery is not the optimally recovered state in any way. It's an optimal recovery like which describes the best reverse channel, which defines the appropriate reverse channel given your prior knowledge. But this optimality still is not optimal relative to what you've seen, because it hasn't accounted for what you've seen. The optimal recovery channel is defined without ever taking into account the observed output. So it's not playing the game that you're describing, Rob.
I don't know. I mean, I talk about observation in the classical case, but I don't need to look at the output of the channel. I could just take the output of the channel and feed it into a process that is guaranteed to spit out the maximum likelihood of that distribution, which I've characterized. I mean, you know, that processing has to depend on your characterization of the noise channel, clearly. Maybe it is not what I'm looking for, but I don't feel like observation is critical. The quantum case, obviously, you can't find out what the pure state is or where you are in the block sphere. So there it really is, you're just going to be feeding that into some processing that depends on your characterization of the noise channel.
But the output of the optimal recovery map, as we've seen in like those contracted pictures that you have, is not pure, right?
Sure.
It's rarely pure. So if you're expecting to sort of always get back a pure state to play your game, then the output of the recovery is not what you're looking for.
Well, but it's a description of an ensemble. So even in the classical case, the optimal recovery involves, finding the maximum likelihood from the posterior and reporting that. But that, whether that's zero or one, you know, in some fraction of the cases, it is zero, in some fraction of the cases, one. So overall, it would be described as a mixture of those two. And I think it's the same thing here, that I can think of that, the points on that ellipsoid, as sometimes you're maybe submitting the pure state that has the highest weight on that guy, and sometimes you're submitting the antipodal state. On average, you're submitting that mixed state.
What mixed state? On average, you're submitting what mixed state? Because every single point in there is a mixed state, which is...
Well, I'm talking about a particular mixed state on the surface of that ellipsoid, which describes the optimal recovery. So like take a point on that ellipsoid, the green one, and sort of decompose it into the pure states that are on the line that intersects that point and the center of the block sphere.
Okay, but in this case, for example, if you take as a prior something that is not in the center, and it was this one, so this ellipsoid will be here, for example. And if you connect the center...
Different... I agree that one's harder to think about. I think Lucien might have had a question.
Yes.
We can't hear you, Lucien.
Okay.
But go ahead.
Okay, maybe you can hear me now. Had a more general comment. So here, one of the things that in some sense is thwarting you is that you're working, that the quantum theory is time asymmetric, you had an example that with the contracting map and the optic map doesn't exist. And more generally, you know, the constraints on channels are there could be positive traits on increasing, which is a time way of thinking. So I've worked on time symmetric formulation of quantum theory, so it's equivalent, but in some sense you repackage it in a different way. And in that case, there's a very natural notion of reversing a channel. So every channel has a reverse, but the motivation is different. So you're motivated by some kind of optimization, whereas the motivation there is that if you take a circuit and then you construct another circuit where you replace every channel by its time reverse, you kind of basically turn that circuit upside down, then you should get the same probability that you had before. So it's a different notion of reversing a channel.
Okay, but if you take as you can decompose it with many different circuits, no?
Say again, sorry.
You have different decomposition with circuits.
So I mean, you take some circuit, just take a simple circuit. You have A followed by B followed by C. Okay. Well, there exists another circuit, which is C tilde. C tilde is the time reverse of C, followed by B tilde, followed by A. Okay, this circuit's a closed, so there's no wires sticking out at the end. It has a probability associated with it. The reason I mention it is it's a different way of thinking about the time reverse. You're not trying to optimize what it does. Rather, you're trying to, the time reverse is meant to give you the same probabilities for time inverted. So
yes.
But the time symmetric, but even if you're interested in optimization, working in a time symmetric framework, like the one I have in my recent paper, might be useful because then at least you're not mathematically hindered by the fact that you have different spaces for the reverse. I mean, conceptually, it's a little bit tricky sometimes to think in these time symmetric ways, but it's equivalent to the usual time forward way of thinking. It's just a comment, really. I don't have a specific point.
But this was sort of the idea of why bias should be important in a sense, where this symmetry, you know, but the reverse, reversing it again, you obtain again the initial map.
Mm-hmm.
And so this work starts from these optimization problems, but it's never asking really physical things like these time symmetries. And it looks like if you ask time symmetries, I mean, time symmetry and this involutivity, then maybe you have bias in this context. But I don't know the work that you're referring to.
I can, you go on the archive, it's, I think it's the most recent paper I have anyway. It's a paper called, has time symmetry in the title.
But it's a long
paper, so if you look at page 120 on that paper, it talks about this in reverse. It's equivalent to standard quantum theory, so it's not. It's just a repackaging of the framework, and so it might be a good place to think about optimality questions as well.
Okay, but just a question. But this, because you are talking about circuit, I was imagining like circuit of unitaries and so on. But you are not talking about circuits.
No, I'm talking about. They may not be unitaries. You know, so each box can have outcomes on it.
Okay. And this inversion of each box, what is it?
So there's a particular way of inverting each box. It sort of involves taking the adjoint. Something similar has been done in the world of Bob Kircher and so on.
Okay.
The best way to see it is you have a time symmetric, so you have the Steinspring extension.
Yes.
In standard quantum theory, there's a time symmetric version of that. And when you have the time symmetric version, then there's a very natural inverse. So that appears. But the point of that inverse is not to optimize, it's to get the same probability for a circuit.
But if you take the Steinspring dilation,
yeah,
you have a unitary, so it's always invertible, no?
The standard Steinspring dilation has an ancillary in a pure state coming in the bottom.
Yes,
and it has an ignore on the top. So you just ignore the outcome of the ancillary.
Top. Okay.
So that's not invertible because you're just tracing over the.
You trace off, it's not invertible,
but in the case of the time reversible in the time symmetric framework, the Steinspring dilation has a noisy channel coming in, a mixed state coming in, completely mixed state coming in, and it also has tracing over the top, so it's a more time symmetric notion. There's a natural time inverse to that. I doubt it would satisfy the kind of optimality criteria. It does have the does have the property that if that panel is unitary, then of course it's unreversible.
Mm-hmm. He's on, yes.
I can't remember your other properties, but it probably wouldn't be optimal in every respects. Anyway.
Because if you think about this TeamSpring dilation, you can also think about this kind of inversion in this bigger space without even thinking about the prior, for example. If you want to forget about the prior, you don't want to have any reference data, mm-hmm. you can think about the inversion as a maximization over this ordinance seal or all the freedom that you have when you expand with the Stinner Spring.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't try to understand that.
Okay, so did I thank you for this? I don't know if you have any other questions.
No, it's not.
Okay. And there's a question from Ellie.
I hope this is a quick question. I was just wanted to ask about the statement about a finite number of vertices. I'm used to semi-definite programs defining convex sets, where we're still to impose, but that convex set does not have a finite number of vertices, even though there's a finite number of sort of conditions. So typically I justify a finite number of vertices in linear programming from a finite number of linear inequalities. But here we have these sort of like all eigenvalues are positive, which is not exactly a linear degree. And I've often found that that leads to not a finite number of vertices. So what's the justification, or is there one for why it's a finite set? Or is that only like in the classical case it's finite, but in the quantum set it's not finite,
course,
it's convex?
Only in the classical case there's a finite number of vertices, okay? In the quantum case, you can do like, well, it's a condition from a Choi theorem on the Krauss operators, or if you like Choi matrices more, it's a marginal problem. So you set the marginals of the channels. This impose, setting the marginals to some state that you want is sort of imposing a fixed transition between these two marginals of the channels of the Choi. So you can, I don't know, if you want to think about like inequality, this is a system with two fixed marginals, and this leads to a super big set of inequality from this paper of Kalishiansk, I don't remember the name, but so yes, in the quantum case it's different and there are just extreme points, there are no vertices.
Thanks, appreciate it. I see that Rob has also another question.
Yes.
Yeah, I did. So it's, I guess I wanted to ask to what extent your optimal retrieval map should be thought of as a kind of error correction scheme, right? So if I think of the original map as a noisy quantum channel, then to what extent is your optimal retrieval map optimal for error correction?
Okay, so on this topic, I remember that at some point I got a guy contacted me talking about error mitigations for quantum computers, so this kind of stuff. Uh-huh. But they wanted, it's like a method, you obtain an output, there was some noise at the end, and they want to mitigate this error from the noise. And he sent me this paper from Kitaev, where they were working for this error correction way of doing. So they wanted to correct the error from this noise channel at the end of the computations. And they had a condition that was really similar to this determinant maximization for finding the optimal one. I never investigated too much because I've seen that it was really similar. So I just thought, okay, doesn't make sense to go deeper because it was a really technical question and the results were really similar, at least for the concept of the idea, what is the best one. Mm. But I think that this is the only clue that I have that this is actually really working as error correction. And it's also fault in a sense in error correction community.
Yeah, my impression is that often in error correction, there's the, you know, people want perfect error correction and a kind of imperfect error correction scheme is not of much interest. So, you know, the question of, well,
yes,
what's a correction scheme that'll get me as close in fidelity to the original state, it's just not so interesting because...
Yes, and this is why I think there's the difference between error correction and this error mitigation.
But, okay, maybe the phrase is error mitigation. Yeah. So let me ask something different. There's a way of thinking about all of this that I think is maybe means it's been thought about more in quantum information, which is if the input to your channel is classical, then I can think of that channel as basically a set of states. For every classical input, there's a quantum state that gets output mm-hmm. from the channel. So I can think of that you know, what you might have thought as sort of the noise channel, as really just, you know, a quantum encoding of classical data.
Okay.
Encode my data in density operators rather than probability distributions. Mm-hmm. And let's, for the simplicity, imagine that the prior over the different classical messages is the same.
Okay.
So then the question might become something like, okay, if I want to, again, single shot, guess what the input of the channel was, that's just state discrimination. I want an optimal scheme for distinguishing mm-hmm. the different outputs that will allow me to guess the input. And in that context, this sort of PETS recovery is what's called the pretty good measurement. So yes. If you sort of write down the PETS recovery map for this sort of instance, you get a particular POVM, which people call the pretty good measurement. It's not mm-hmm. optimal, but it's a sort of a good place to start. You can show that it does pretty well.
Yes.
But the optimal measurement is the solution of a semi-definite program, right? So there's a lot of results that have shown that, you know, you give me a set of density operators and you want to know what's the optimal POVM to do to distinguish them. In general, mm-hmm. there's a semi-definite program that answers that question. So I guess am I right to think that your optimal retrieval, if specialized to this example that I'm talking about, would give the solution of that semi-definite program? Or
so the solution of the semi-definite program is this pretty good measurement.
No. The pretty good measurement is like this non-optimal thing.
Okay.
That's recovery map. It's
yes, so it's coming from
in it just because, oh, it's easy. It's easy to write it down. You don't have to do anything fancy like solve a semi-definite program.
Yes.
And it does pretty well in some sense. Like you can sort of quantify a sense. Oh, I can bound the error that it makes in this and this way. But you know, when people ask what is the optimal measurement you can do to distinguish
the solution of a semi-definite program, and I don't know actually, but might be, no, because it's in this case we have a semi-definite program optimization. It's not semi-definite program, it's this determinant maximization, and you have a channel back.
But is, I guess you showed the title of a textbook which had semi-definite.
Yes,
and determinant maximization. Optimization. So are they just two versions of the same problem? Like
even that I checked a long time ago, but I don't remember. It's not that the same, but the point is that you can just map this problem of determinant maximization to a linear program in some way. I remember, but so,
In the case I just described,
yes.
So let's say you've got N states, row one, row two to row N.
Yes.
Now you're looking for a POVM that has N outcomes. So let's call the POVM elements E1, E2, all the way to EN.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, you want trace of row I, EI, the probability that you guess I when you've got outcome EI. You want to maximize that posterior probability of guessing correctly. The non-trivial constraint is that the EIs are positive operators, and so if I write down the thing, you know, the that I'm trying to maximize, and you know, so there's an expression for the probability of guessing the correct state, but then I have all these inequalities that say, okay, those EIs all have to be positive, and that's why mm-hmm. it's a semi-definite program. It's sort of
yes
matrix inequalities. But if your optimal retrieval is the kind of optimal measurement when the input has to be classical, then this determinant maximization has to be also a solution of the same. It has to be equivalent to solving the semi-definite program.
Yeah, so to check either this,
or maybe your optimal retrieval is something different from the optimal.
But if it is, it will mean but this channel is connected to this set of POVM.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yes, the
so this Krauss operator are just
the retrieval channel just is a POVM, right? Like, what are the inputs and outputs of the retrieval channel? It has a quantum input and a classical output. Mm-hmm. That is describing a POVM.
So they if they coincide,
right?
They should be. Yes, should I have no idea about this. I did. And okay, but channels and POVM are connected by this or the square root going one direction or the other. Maybe. I don't know. I was thinking if this because the determinant the constraint that you're saying is like this maximizing the composition of all these traces, a linear composition of the trace of all the POVM with the states over the set of all these positive operators. And in one case, you have the maximization of this determinant. And well, I don't know, but it's a good thing to check actually, because maybe it's this. Also, because it's really weird, you know, the semi-definite program determinant are connected, they are similar, we are doing sort of the same thing. And we have, in both cases, a numerically computable thing. There are not so many, and they should be at least connected, they are.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess for me, I would like to understand better whether you're if I'm thinking about your optimal retrieval map correctly.
Yes. So
in the case where the input is classical and the output is quantum, it's a little bit easier to describe what I'm asking, which is your optimal retrieval map the optimal POVM for the task of correctly guessing which state you had or not? And so if you can reframe your optimal retrieval map in that special case of classical input, quantum output, then it sort of becomes easier to sort of see whether my intuition is correct.
Yes. But okay, and to encode a a classical input in a quantum, you just in block sphere, like for example, super easy.
Yeah.
In this case, what kind of encoding will you take? I mean, the simplest thing is just taking something on the axis of the block sphere, but.
Well, like, okay, if you want some.
But it's really super classical. It's so super classical. No, you're just encoding on the probability of having X or no Z plus or Z minus.
Here's an example that you'll find in Perez's textbook. Imagine you're encoding a classical trit in three quantum states that lie on an equilateral triangle on a plane of the block sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're pure, like psi one, psi two, psi three, and they're just
forming
an equilateral triangle. So Perez works out what it turns out that the measurement that allows you to guess and maximize your probability of guessing correctly is a three outcome POVM.
Yes.
Okay, and. And so it's not projective. It's
mm-hmm.
can't be written as a mixture of projective measurements. It has to be done by Neumark dilation, for example.
So yes,
that's one of the things Perez mentions about it. But it's a simple example of your scheme could what you call the optimal retrieval map. So the map now, the noise map is one that maps the trit to psi one, psi two, psi three. You know, each of those three values of the trit gets mapped to psi one, psi two, psi three. With say a uniform distribution over the values of the trit. And then if you say, okay, now I compute the retrieval map, if it ends up describing, the optimal POVM, well, that it supports the conjecture that I had that get out the optimal measurement. So that would be a simple case to test. That problem is so easy that you didn't need to use a semi-definite program to solve it. It was sort of straightforward to do it
analytically. Yes.
And there's a few other examples like that that you could look at, like maybe a tetrahedron of states, for instance, in the block.
Okay, I'm gonna check this. Nice. Thank you.
So, yeah, Kovac, I want to thank you again. I think this is going to be a great seminar. I'm glad we haven't had it. Okay. We'll put it up on Thursday with your consent. And hopefully we'll talk soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks to you.